The speaker is Hassan Piker, who is a political commentator, predominantly streaming on the platform Twitch. And he has created a very large following with the progressive left-leaning guest student body in general. He is known as the kind of predominant speaker for issues that I guess seem to be conflicting in mass media, but for a lot of Gen Z young people, it's pretty clear. So the main issues that he kind of discusses are a lot to do with the issues with both parties, not just the conservatives, but also the Democrats in the United States, because he is located in Los Angeles. And he is of Turkish descent, but kind of studied in America for most of his career. And he has allowed a lot of, I think, young people to feel more motivated and more empowered to be involved in the democratic or system, the kind of, including, I guess, voices. And he always has people on his Twitch stream that are from very both sides, I think. So he tries to incorporate a lot of, discourse that maybe is missed on the main kind of news cycles. So his controversies that's coming up for this event specifically comes from the Center of Jewish and Israeli Association of Canada. And that statement was released around a month ago, basically stating that the CIJA is concerned about his presence at the UBC's Chan Center tonight. And I think it's because, they wrote that it's because of his associations with anti-Zionist beliefs. And they're in some ways conflating his anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. This is a kind of perception that a lot of people have of Hassan Piker over the years, because he is very vocal and very pro-Palestine. And so a lot of the people who are against his presence usually locate his kind of strong words against the Israeli occupation and genocide of Palestinians.
Yeah, and that's a very common, criticism or sort of retort to anyone who criticizes the actions of Israel as a state or the Zionist movement, right? That's a very sort of common play to then sort of accuse that person of anti-Semitism, right?
Yeah, and I think that it's not the first time that he has been accused of these beliefs, and he has very many times gone on air and had to really break down his perspective on this issue, and still, regardless of how many times he has, made it clear that he is not anti-Semitic and rather actually propels a lot of pro-Jewish sentiments on his accounts in order to combat anti-Semitism, it just never ends up being heard. I think that what happens is that the cherry-picked moments in which, when you're Twitch streaming for hours on end, you kind of will end up saying things that can be perceived as very strong and strong beliefs. And so a lot of the times he has been banned on Twitch as well because of his wording and his choice of rhetoric, I guess, too. I think that there is something to be said about the impact and the importance of using your words wisely and choosing and being able to direct your commentary in a way that doesn't create these really big social upheavals, because even though he has dealt with this so many times, the more and more amount of people who hear that he is anti-Semitic will end up believing this, right? And so it really reduces a lot of the support that you can have of this creator and more of the progressive party or the progressive perceptions in general. And so I do see that Hassan even though he's like praised for his like crassness, I think it's something that he also should be aware that it can create a lot of inherent like dissociation from the actual arguments that he's presenting. Mm-hmm. But I feel like at the end of the day, you know, the actual like what is it, the presentation I guess he's doing, the talk that he's doing sold out in 3 minutes. So it was pretty clear that a lot of people are really excited about his presence on the UBC campus and in Vancouver specifically. I think that young people are really in desire for hearing people that do have strong opinions and that are deep in their convictions about the things that really matter to us, which are, you know, anti-genocidal like sentiments and also raising awareness of issues that do not get presented in the mass media because they are of, I guess, against common like perceptions or against these like ideologies that are so entrenched within our society.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's really interesting in terms of like the appeal and, as you're saying, like selling out in 3 minutes, and the audience that he is speaking to is like a younger audience that, you know, we're all, and when I say we are, like societally, we're all hoping that young people will be passionate about politics and will get involved in these issues, while also sort of balancing and walking that like, okay, but yeah, words matter. Mm-hmm. And we do also need to hold people to account to embody the ideals that we want to move forward, right?
Definitely. And I think that that's what is really important in Vancouver specifically, in a place where we might feel like disempowered politically. There was a response actually by someone in the Green Party, Avi Lewis, who is known, I think, by a lot of like young people in Vancouver as like maybe the new wave of, you know, progressive and very thoughtful, you know, political figures. And he released a statement saying that he's excited to welcome Hassan to the university, and as well linked to a briefing on the group, which posted the controversy and instigated this kind of controversy against him coming onto campus. He posted basically a briefing that they wrote by the Jewish Faculty Network, and it's a report on the pattern of anti-Palestinian racism and genocidal denial at the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs. And this report really outlines the impact of the Center of Israel and Jewish Affairs in propelling very like anti-Palestinian and also very like hateful rhetoric that doesn't actually propel or protect Jewish communities, but rather just entrenches the issue of Israel and really doesn't allow people to express the grievances that they have of the state in which is committing a genocide. And so I think that having a person like Avi Lewis of the Green Party talking about this issue too and like raising awareness and also linking to very well thought out and a very like well researched briefing that was really separately, like that's not released in, as a response to this. This was briefing was released in October of 2025. And so it does offer a lot of people to get the opportunity to understand maybe the mechanics behind an organization like the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, in which, you know, they, of course, everyone, you know, wants to combat anti-Semitism. But if you're pointing at people in which definitely have not been actually anti-Semitic, then the people that are anti-Semitic end up kind of going and being brushed under the carpet, you know? And so I think that there needs to be a lot more accountability on behalf of organizations that are causing controversy where controversy is not needed, because at the end of the day, like Hassan has been attributed to a lot of people that actually were able to combat their own anti-Semitic beliefs.
Yeah, it's important to know where information is coming from and be dialed in. We got to turn to our next story now, so thanks for joining me. Our next piece is an interview I did with Cor Case from Afro Van Connect about a Black History walking tour. You can go to vanmaritime.com to get tickets to that. It is next Saturday, February 21st, at the Vancouver Museum out by Kitts Beach. So without further ado, we'll get into that. Thanks again, Serena.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Cor Case. I am from Vancouver, BC. I like to call myself a social retrofitter, and I'm here with the Vancouver Museum about to do an amazing tour featuring hidden history, Black history, and as well as talking about food, land practices, and culturally relevant food specifically.
You said cultural retrofitter?
Social retrofitter.
Yeah. What do you mean by that?
I mean that I think that the work that I've done particularly has been championing and advocating for space for people of African descent. And a lot of the times when we think of spaces, a lot of times we think of, oh, maybe we need to build something new, which I do believe is important, that there's essential that we build new spaces. But what about the old spaces? How do we bring the old spaces into the future? And I think the best way we do that is through upgrading, through social retrofitting. So changing programming, creating more accessible spaces, inviting different communities, different people into space, to share in space, to commune together, and to reimagine what the future of that space could be. Because in order to make it sustainable, we need to be thinking about who is not in the room and how could they come and be present in the room. So that's kind of what I say I do. I'm a social retrofitter.
Okay. How did you come into this work?
It started off as an artist, and I was an artist looking for space in the city of Vancouver, and there's not that many spaces at that time for artists to perform or to gather. And so a few other artists within specifically the African descent community started to gather and create community partnerships with other spaces. And then through that, offering programming, offering culturally relevant education, offering consulting, and it became more of a realizing that there's a lot of people and spaces that could be supported by the work that I do. And so it just became something intentionally that I wanted to do in relation to have some level of impact, I guess, within community and understanding that it's necessary. Because what I did end up finding through the journey was that there are a lot of spaces, and sometimes we don't need to build new spaces, we just find ways to utilize what we have. So it's kind of a way of being sustainable and understanding that in Vancouver there is a limited amount of space in which the city has to operate and use on, as we are on unceded territories and Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. So being mindful of how we use that space intentionally, practically, and so asking a lot of these questions kind of led me along this journey. And so this is where I'm currently at, and it's still expanding. I'm still learning every day, but I think it has allowed me to be more optimistic and also to offer something of impact to community.
You've mentioned a couple times not needing to build new spaces, but sort of reclaiming or changing or refurbishing existing spaces. Mm-hmm. What are some of those spaces that you found to reclaim?
I think a lot of the times we were focusing on a lot of institutional spaces, finding that there has been a history of systemic oppression and racism that has existed in a lot of institutional spaces. So a lot of people who find themselves racialized or marginalized don't enter those spaces for a reason. And a lot of these spaces I found systemically finding issues maintaining retention when it comes to diverse communities. And so you ask the question, well, why? And then when you start to look at the history, you start to see, well, maybe these spaces weren't made intentionally to support these individuals or to welcome them. And some of that, the remnants of that ideology still is in the space. So then how do we change that and how do we solve that alongside, like I said, creating new spaces, but at the same time seeing how we can utilize to bring everyone forward, or at least those spaces that want to transition into something, I think, more sustainable and more welcoming to the ever-changing, expanding demographic of Canada and the world globally.
We're doing this interview in one of those institutions. Mm-hmm. What has it been like working with the Museum of Vancouver, and what has that process been?
I think the Museum of Vancouver, it's been a great opportunity to work with them. They understand the importance of creating intentional spaces and also shedding light upon diverse histories and promoting, I would like to say, reconciliation and truth and expansion and having conversations and dialogues about things that are necessary. Because the truth is required for us to move forward, and understanding how these pieces and how we all played a role within how things are currently and how we can together collectively move forward. And I think the museum has been a great space for that. And also it's been one of the, I think museums and typically are spaces where people come for that kind of reflection, perspective changing. And so it was the perfect place. And I found great reception with the Museum of Vancouver as being a space to hold those type of conversations and to amplify the experience of people of African descent in Vancouver and them making it intentionally something that they want to do in a way that's authentic, in a way that brings other people who have lived experiences and diverse experiences into the room to participate in the process of developing what that looks like.
Let's talk more about space and spaces. Do you have a favorite place or space in Vancouver?
Interesting. I think I'm a space file. I love space. We have a program called Black Spaces Symposium, and we talk about different spaces and how we can utilize those spaces and how to promote specifically African descent culture in diverse spaces and how that looks like and how we can imagine that. I think my favorite space, I'd say probably the garden spaces are probably my favorite spaces, just because nature is welcoming to everyone. Everyone can show up. Everyone can find themselves in nature. Everyone can learn. I think it's like a grand unifying, it is the space. It is the place where we can come together and ground ourselves. And everyone is, I know, differently affected by the space, but everyone collectively can be like, we feel something. And so I think like amplifying natural spaces is important. But I really, besides a physical space, I do really like, to be honest, not just... I do like the Vancouver Museum. I think it's very cool. I do also like the Vancouver Public Library. I think it's great. I think the art gallery is really great downtown as well. And yeah, I think there's a few other spaces, but they're the top of mind. I think those are kind of the three that come to mind.
There's a few things I pull out of there. One is, you know, a few of the spaces you've mentioned are those institutional spaces, mm-hmm. and that really speaks to the importance of making sure that those spaces are for everyone and reflective of the wide diversity of people that make up this place mm-hmm. and use these places.
Mm-hmm. Right? I think it's so important because they're kind of the pillar foundational spaces in the city. And so if these are the core of the city and you don't see yourself or you aren't reflected in, if you walk through the halls and you don't see people that are working there or actively participating in programming and developing, it really does affect the way you see what's possible for yourself. And again, does affect retention. I typically like to go places where I know I'm going to be welcome, as everyone does. And so it's like, how do we intentionally support people and make them know that we are open and supportive to them if we don't see them in the space? And I think definitely that's something that the city of Vancouver in general is working on, trying to expand and trying to get into the understanding of what are the barriers. And I think that when we start to have those type of conversations, we can actually hopefully get to some solutions and hopefully change the experience for other people who may not feel so welcome, and hopefully begin to create a history, a future that actually is more inclusive.
The other thing was just the garden piece. Mm-hmm. And I think it is really interesting how much you can learn about both how similar we all are, but also just like about individual cultures and everything just based on what you're planting, what you're harvesting, how you're doing those things, what you're using them for, and all of that.
Exactly. The ecosystem. You see the diversity in real time and how everything supports one another. There's nothing that's wasted in a natural space, in a garden. Everything has a purpose. Everything has a value. And so when you just take that and you flip it and you look at us as human beings, as a community, you know, to me, everyone has value and everyone can be supported and everyone can support. And I think that the ideal reflection of what nature offers is a clear example of that actually being a real thing. And I think that the gift of community is through this community work and through working in the garden, you can also learn about what your strengths are. And you can also be, it can be reflected back to you. And you can also find other things in space that reflect, you know, elements that you may want to embody, you know, which has been really, really cool. And one of the things for me is definitely initially was patience and understanding how much control I actually have over things that are happening, whether it be in my life or other people's lives. which has definitely grounded me and centered me in the point of being like, okay, my responsibility here is to be a steward of the space. And as a steward of the space, what is it to be doing? Pruning, watering, and maintaining the soil. The rest of the sun is not my business. Whether it rains is not my business. You know, there's so many things. So, but it's understanding that it's a collective conversation, collectively working. And also when you take that perspective, like you said, and you put it to problems, you realize that it's not up to me to solve this problem. It's not, this space issue isn't just my issue. It's a collective community issue. Maybe some people in the community don't know that it's an issue. So how do we inspire people? And I think part of the garden, using it as a point of where we not only talk about food security, but also history and also community, gives people a touch point where there's like multiple conversations happening at the same time, very similar to nature's design, natural design, where you can look at something and be inspired by something and learn something all simultaneously. And that's kind of definitely the goal of kind of interrupting people's day-to-day lives and maybe providing them something that they didn't know about their own community or something that can inspire them to be active in their community and maybe hopefully create something intentional that they believe in and that can inspire somebody to do the same.
Yeah, teaching through metaphor or allegory is so effective. Mm-hmm. And being able to show, like, yeah, the interdependence of a garden or a natural ecosystem and all that is mm-hmm. really interesting.
Yeah, it typically, honestly, that foundational wisdom, yeah, it governs my understanding. And within everything, I kind of look at a natural perspective. It's like, oh, well, what control do I actually have right now? And I center on that. And then anything else that's not in that, I release. And it really has, even for my mental health, has supported me immensely. Mm-hmm. Because then I'm more empowered with what I have control over, and what I don't have control over, I can surrender it. And I can allow it in the sense of, like, the harvest. I did all that I can do, and this is what we got from it.
Yeah, hoping that's, for more.
Hoping for next year. Next year, we'll learn. What did we learn? What did we didn't learn? What worked? What didn't work? And so it definitely allows you to have definitely like a more graceful approach. And then also you can share that grace to your community and other people. It's like, you know, a lot of the things that we're talking about truth, reconciliation, reclaiming land, reclaiming space, sovereignty, all of these things are really huge, large concepts that sometimes certain communities, because of our positionality, have been thinking of these things a lot longer than others have. But that doesn't diminish the fact that other people need to become aware of these same things. And so understanding that, again, some things bloom earlier than others, you know, it doesn't marginalize the process. Everything is moving as it should in accordance. And just trusting that, you know, by providing spaces and becoming aware of that this space helped me bloom, then let me offer that back into community and maybe that could do something for somebody else in the form of succession or evolution or expansion.
It's a really good look into sort of your philosophy and the way you're approaching this. I'm talking to you today specifically because of the Black History walking tour and tasting. What can you tell me about that? What can people expect?
I think it's going to be a really cool event. So we are talking about food. Heritage Week this year is about culture and specific cultural cuisine. And so we have two amazing food curators and chefs. One who's Alba Patties. They come from Caribbean descent. And then we have Kisha Mama, who is... her family is from America as well as Caribbean descent. So we have a range of soul food as well as Caribbean food. And there's going to be flavors and spices. Some of the things that we grow in the garden will be cooked. Obviously, it's winter right now. So just in theory, the things that we do grow, at least the things we talk about, you'll be able to get a taste of. We'll be talking about key figures within BC Black history, as well as talking about key figures in agriculture and people who help foundationally support in the structure of what we now know as British Columbia. I think it's also important to note that when we talk about the history of people of African descent, we understand that a lot of people that came here came under duress as chattel slaves through transatlantic slave trade, so their energy and their time and labor were stolen. So it's a mixed history of being a stolen person on stolen land, but we do want to recognize the fact that it's important to honor the laws and the governance that existed here from the Indigenous communities. And so finding a way to mirror and talk about both histories in a way showing the collective understanding of what hopefully the future can be, and also the lived experiences of people of African descent on these lands.
A lot of the time when talking about Vancouver's Black history, the discussion is centered around Hogan's Alley.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a conscious choice to have the walking tour in a different part of the city? Is that just sort of geographical coincidence?
It's a little bit of both. I think one of the things with when we specifically think about the gardens here in Kitsilano, I think Black history and African history is everyone's, and it doesn't have to be sequestered to a particular space. I think Black spaces are everywhere, culture spaces are everywhere, and I think that the beauty is finding a way that how can we culturally dress and offer information in ways that's sustainable. And I think sometimes putting the weight in just one particular part of the city actually does erase the conversation, because some people may not be able to ever get to that part of the city to even know if that history exists. So finding ways to integrate through community and create, whether it be gardens or monuments or spaces that can tell the story, I think allow people to realize that, hey, wait a minute, like, yes, people of African descent ended up in Hogan's Alley, but they didn't start there. And I think that there's also histories of redlining, there's histories of segregation, histories of suppression of where Black bodies could be. Realistically, in a world where there was, let's say, a utopia, we would be everywhere, and we wouldn't be sequestered. So our stories and our names and our history would be more expansive than what it currently is. I think the work that Hogan's Alley is doing is amazing. I think that's an important, impactful work. But also expanding the conversation, understanding that Black spaces are everywhere. And I think that they should be all over the Lower Mainland. Like, there should be accessible points for all, whether it be the Asian community, whether it be the South Asian community, I think it's or Southern community. I think history needs to be accessible. And when it's not, it's easily forgotten.
Can you pull, like, a highlight from the tour, or, like, one thing that you particularly like sharing with people?
One thing I particularly like sharing, I think that sometimes when I talk about the fact that it was something that took me years to know, that literally 800 freed slaves from the San Francisco area migrated from the San Francisco area into the Vancouver Island in 1858 is something that initially I did not even think of, because of the erasure and what happened subsequently when they came up here. But understanding that there was foundational presence of people of African descent that had an impact within the structure of what we see today, and who helped bring whether it be agricultural practices, religious institutions, just ways of being supporting foundationally dominant protective associations, whether it be the African Rifles, you start to realize, like, oh, wow, that this is not new. This is not, like, my presence in this space is not new. My desire to implement and be in community and add value in community is not something that's new. And I think that when you learn the history of those that came before you, it empowers you to be like, hey, what can I add? And you also learn that, wow, some of these people were literally amazing. So you mean that you ran away from slavery from Missouri all the way crossing to California, then starting your whole life there, being persecuted there, and then migrating again into another community in another country, and then building again, and then migrating again. It's like, how many lives? Like, you know, like, literally. And it's just like, wow, okay, I'm complaining about what? I'm allowing what to affect me? And I think that type of level of resilience and that level of determination to believe that you deserve to have access to live and to express and to grow, and that desire to seek those spaces was so strong that it motivated them to keep moving and keep pushing. I think those are the type of things that I embody, and I think that hopefully you want to share ultimately with everyone that adversity is something in this life that we may not choose when we're going to experience it, but we can definitely choose to persevere through it, to live through it, to walk through it, to push through it, and to find some level of joy, and to find some level of reverence for ourselves and our community along the way.
Yeah, and to do all that in the 1800s, when it's like, you're not taking a flight, you're not taking even a train, right?
Yeah, you're on boat. Like, how are you, like, all is, I was tired for you. Like, and that's just the traveling in between. That's not even the persecution. That's not even, like, the day-to-day life of the mindset that you have to put yourself in. People seeing you as less than human, not even recognizing your value as a person. These are still things that people today are experiencing, and I think that we don't want to speak about slavery as it's something in the distant past, because people are experiencing similar type of experiences, not to the varying degree, but in the sense that there's still an occupation on human bodies, there's still an occupation of space, and so none of us are free until all of us are free. And so I think looking at these histories and then understanding these stories just teaches you the resilience and the importance to hold on to what you deserve, which is your inalienable right to seek for freedom and to stand for what you believe in.
Once again, the BC Heritage Week Black History Walking Tour is Saturday, February 21st at the Vancouver Maritime Museum. Then.